And it's sexy. Sexy, the other thing about short stories, they can be so sexy, so erotic, so disturbing on sexual levels.
Hello, and welcome to the first in a series of specially commissioned podcasts brought to you by Thresholds, the online international short story forum hosted by the University of Chichester, who have joined forces this year with Small Wonder, the Short Story Festival, to record four amazing discussions that we're calling Short Story Masterclass. My name's Steve Wasserman, and in this podcast you're about to hear, I talk with the wonderful Sarah Hall about cat-dog writing, what it means to write intuitively, what makes for a killer short story, damn squibs, resuscitating damn squibs, research and the limits of, as well as a whole host of other extremely sexy thoughts and notions. We'll be looking quite a bit at Sarah's short story, The Nightlong River, which you might want to read first. There's a link you can follow from the Threshold site, and then do come back and join us for the discussion. Take it away, Sarah.
We knew from the November berries what the next months would bring. Everywhere they were hung and clotted in the bushes, ripe and red, like blisters of blood. The hollies came out in autumn and gave us ideas about selling genuine reeds at the hired lad during Advent, rather than staining ivy with sheep's raddle, as we'd done in the bolder years. Rose hips clung on, well past their season, until the birds eventually went with them. The yarrow and rowan hung out their own gaudy bunting. But it was the hawthorn that was the truest messenger that year, for it had blossomed wildly in May too. The hawthorn sent the hedgerows ruddy as a battle. It meant a full winter of snow. It meant hoarfrosts that would stop the hearts of mice in their burrows and harden tree sap under its white grip. The ground would only ever half thaw until spring, like a clod of beef brought from the pantry and moved from cold room to cold room. Flocks would be lost under the drifts. There were other signs that got read too by the older villagers. The moon's full eclipse in October. Up along the Solway they said the salmon had run in early, and there was talk of 47 when the fishermen had walked over the frozen sea towards Man with their creels. To whichever quarter a bull faces lying down on All Hallows, from there the wind will blow the better part of the winter, the old saying goes. And Sarge Dickinson's Hereford had its withers turned north that day. I saw it as I passed by the paddock, holding on to Magda's arm.
You originally studied poetry and short stories at the University of St Andrews. You did an MA.
I did.
And you've talked in interviews about wanting to write a kind of poetry-prose hybrid. I think you even call it cat-dog fiction.
Did I? Good lord.
Somewhere. which I love. I'm
watching too many cartoons, naturally.
And I was wondering, particularly in that first paragraph of that story, how close does that get to you for that kind of poetry-prose hybrid? That you're aiming for?
Yeah, I suppose it's there, really. And it sounds a bit odd, but because you would assume perhaps that the early drafting process is a little less descriptive, you know, maybe a little less vivid, but actually stuff comes out that way in the early stages. And I don't know what it is, it just helps me compose to think about things that way, to think in a very visual way, a visceral way. So of course there's tidying up to do in the later drafts, but that strange, I suppose it's been called muscular in the past, that strange form of description is there right from the beginning. And in a way, it's almost necessary for me to proceed with what I'm doing.
How do you make sure when you're writing that you don't just sort of get lost in the cat poetry of it all?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And it's very important to balance the two. And again, I think that comes in later drafts. Often, you know, a story may be top heavy or bottom heavy or just heavy somewhere, and that needs to be cut back. So, and I think it's okay. I'm always saying to people that I teach, you know, never berate the way that you work in the first instance. You know, you write as you write, you draft as you draft. It's imperfect. We all are. And it's what you do with it after that. So, you know, the language might be there to a more heightened degree in the beginning, and it'll need to be thinned down at a later stage and balanced out with dog moving forward, dog running after stick, dog eating, dog doing what dogs do. And that is an important balancing act that has to be performed at some point before the story is ready for consumption. The other thing to say is, it's easier with short stories. I mean, looking back at my early novels, I would say they're a bit too descriptive. You know, were I to be writing them now, I would be balancing a narrative and plot a little bit more with the description. They are what they are. You don't edit yourself in the past, but as a writer, you do develop. And in writing short stories, I've become more aware of a driving energy to the pieces of fiction that I'm working on. And the short story, because you're able to hold more of a sense of it, more of a shape of it in your head, perhaps, and I don't plan them out, I don't plan the novels, I'm writing intuitively, but with a short story it's easier to hold a shape and a sense in your head. I think that enables you in the earlier stages to have forward momentum, to have energy already there, because you have a sense of where you're going, even if it's not completely known. That's how I feel about short stories. I think the form is very good for me because it addresses an area where I'm perhaps a little bit weaker, or not weaker, but my primary focus isn't on corpses and guns going off and people running around. That's not necessarily what I'm interested in, and that's of course a bold statement about what plot is. It's not that. So I think the short story is very good for me, and in a way it improves my writing insofar as I am able to think about plot or narrative earlier than I would perhaps, or have more of a sense of early movement to the pieces. So in a way, I love writing novels, but there's just something about the short story. I just feel like it's doing something for me and my work that I haven't found before. I absolutely love the form. I think it's really suitable for me and what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for this story, which is such a peculiar story in the best sense, Where did you start?
Yeah, I started with the berries because we had... Right. I was living in the north at the time, and we had one of those seasons that was just everywhere you turned, there were red berries, and it was just one of those years. And I asked my aunt about it, who's very good at this kind of thing, and she said, well, of course, because we had Mad Blossom in May. So I love folklore and I love folk knowledge and just the natural world. And so that seemed enough, the idea that... these signs happen in nature and people of a certain generation or a certain culture or a certain tradition will interpret them. It means something bad's coming. It means you're getting a bastard of a winter, basically. Well, that was great. That was enough to start with. And then of course what writers do is magpie. They bring in all kinds of things that they see and that are going on in life. I'd had a friend who was very ill with a brain tumour, wasn't diagnosed for a while. I didn't really know what was going on. She was okay. By the time I got to write the novel, she was okay. She'd had an extensive operation. But that was going on in the background. It was sort of in the hinterland of the story that I was imagining I might write. So that sort of comes into it, the idea of a girl who's very ill. At the time, living in the contemporary West, as I was thinking, well, thank God that they could perform this surgery. What was a very difficult surgery to get a brain tumour out. And this was sort of, this elided with this old kind of folk knowledge of hedgerow knowledge, I suppose, flora knowledge. And I started thinking, well, yeah, 100 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. What an amazing thing, but how tragic, So, when my aunt was very young, this surgery probably wouldn't have been available. And the two things came together, and that's always what happens. All these things combine into some kind of story, into some kind of scenario. And the mink, yeah, what was happening with the mink? I think there was a lot of chunter about hunting bans at the time. And that came into it too, that everything just seemed to go well together. I wanted to write a folk tale. Because you're thinking about hedgerow knowledge and signs and traditions and meaning in the moon, meaning in the hedgerows. And you think folktale. But of course, folktales and fables and myths and fairy tales, which the short story, has found a very comfortable home with in the past, are always changing. They never stay the same. There are no two versions really the same. And so you're allowed to crack tradition and move on into something else. And in all my work, there are hopefully interesting and electrifying female characters who are going about their business, and their business may not be traditionally female in nature, but they're completely competent. Or if they're not competent, they're going to try and be competent. So there you've got a girl... who decides to go hunting to, you know, make some kind of tinker-like, poacher-like coat for her friend who's very sick with a brain problem that they don't quite know what's going on. It all came together. And there is a logic that begins to take hold.
I love the phrase that you use, this, the assemblage of vermin, to describe the coat. And I was wondering if, in a way, and also in the way you just talked about how you've assembled the story, if that's actually quite a nice metaphor for short stories.
Very true. Any piece of fiction, I think. And the language in this story is folkish. It reaches levels of grandiosity at times, because actually you do find that in the countryside. You find an old-fashioned, almost semi-biblical language at play. So some of the word choices in there may seem a little stark, descry at one point.
I did want to actually ask you a little bit about the language, because, I mean, there were a lot of words that I never heard of before. Things like, sheep rattles. This is my little list here. Sheep rattles. Even yarrow and rowan. I feel like I should know that, but I don't. I don't know what that is.
That's dead, just types of plant, tree.
Okay. Stiffening becks, withers, lonning, dual trees, southorn trees. And then the one that I kind of love, because it's the one I got most stuck on and I couldn't actually find anywhere a definition of, is... I'm probably not going to pronounce
Brandt,
it correctly.
Is it?
No, dads?
Dads, yeah. Just means a light dusting of snow.
Right, now I couldn't even find... I mean, that stumped Google.
Yeah, that's Cumbrian. I mean, you need to get a Cumbrian dictionary for this. Yeah, so a lot of these words have fallen out of usage now, and only older generations would remember them, and even some of, you know, some of those wouldn't. So that's kind of delving into the Cumbrian dictionary. Some of these words I'm familiar with. I mean, you do find these old Cumbrian words kicking about still, and they're in play. But certainly, you know, at the turn of the century, they certainly would still have been in play. Mm. Dual is a sycamore tree. It's just a Cumbrian reference for sycamore. Mm. So, but if somebody in that agricultural setting would say dual, they wouldn't say sycamore. So you need to make these choices. You don't necessarily need to go hunting for obscure terms. But I think in this instance, it seemed that was the right choice of reference and word. You know, sycamore would have been
so
right.
So it was about veracity, because I was wondering, you know, why that kind of specificity necessarily, if the reader, as I imagine a number of readers, such as myself, are going to be slightly tripped up and yet also pleasurably tripped up by those words, because it does add a certain texture and a certain tone as well, a certain colour.
Yeah, wherever the vernacular is in play, I think this isn't a rule, but I mean, you do see it in fiction writing. Wherever the vernacular comes in, generally it's in context, in a sentence where you can work out what's meant. Very few writers, I think, unless they're Cormac McCarthy and he's going to give you pages and pages of Spanish dialogue and just, you know, if you don't speak Spanish, tough. I actually quite admire that in him. But I think ordinarily, you know, writers tend, at least in the UK, maybe not so much in Scottish writing, where you do get the full-on vernacular demotic, and that's fine too. You need to pick it up, you need to learn how to speak that language while you're reading the book. But I think on the whole, people use it lightly, writers use it lightly. So you get one word in context, lonning. You can work out what it is, it's a lane. You'll still see lonning on a sign. I mean, you know, Baxter's Lonning, you'll see it as you're driving around in the Lake District. So, but again, I mean, there were more of these words probably in the early drafts, and I went through and I took some of them out, because you need to be careful with them. It can be off-putting. You don't want to use them so heavily that it is making the reader read a foreign language. That is a trip. It is off-putting. It's not right. So there is, again, a balancing act to be had. Where can these words add to the atmosphere and seem flavoursome and not exotic exactly, but seem like they have to seem as if they're part of the DNA of the story, you know, rather than ornamentation, I suppose. So, and that again, that's an editing task. You need to go through and figure that out. Or have a few people read the story, and people who are not from the north read the story, and just see where, you know, where these things are acceptable and where it's a little too heavy-handed.
Mm. Which I think brings us to the question of research and, you know, how much you as the writer need to or decide to go out and find the material to bring back, as opposed to just, you know, sort of pulling the mink out of the hat, as it were. Now, you described yourself as a real geek when it comes to research. Do you remember saying something
probably.
Like that? I was just interested what level of research, if any, was required for this story in particular. I mean, for example, the mink skinning passage. I mean, did that require research? What kind of research was that? Was it a book research?
Was it? No, I haven't. That's so interesting. People always ask you questions you don't expect about research, because actually the problematic aspect of this story was it wasn't entirely located in a specific time. It is, you know, it's sort of early 1900s. It's after the First World War. You get the reference of the Great War in it, but that was added later because I felt that it was too floating. What I was going for originally was a story set in the North that, and you know, the North is very much a place that echoes the past. You know, you have a sense that perhaps we're, you know, 30 years behind the rest of the country. So what I wanted was something that had not a contemporary feel, but a modern feel, but with references to the past, which I think this story has. It has a, you know, you get a reference to 47. Well, that's 1847, you know, which would just and so be in living memory of some of the people, older people in this story. So I wanted that sort of, in a way, a dislocation of time. But then, of course, you do have to locate periods in the work. So actually my main concern was, well, actually, when was the first big mink escape from Norfolk? Because they did get out, they were breeding them and they got out. And I don't really know, to this day I haven't really done that research. But those were my concerns, rather than the kind of skinning of... I've seen someone skin a squirrel, I assume it's pretty much the same thing. So right. I just went with that. And again, you do the research, but actually it's fiction, you know, which isn't an excuse. But it's fiction. You have to have a certain amount of, as you say, veracity. You have to be able to convince the reader of what they're reading, and that you have some kind of local knowledge a lot of the time, or any kind of knowledge pertaining to what you're writing about. But after that, I think most of the time you can get away with it. I hope you can. I do interesting research. I research in a way that I find interesting, and that's tangential. Often it's relevant to what I'm writing about, but it's also bonkers. I mean, wherever possible, I'll talk to people who remember something, because I'd rather have a bastardised version. And that seems realer somehow. That seems more human. I'd rather have that than... Of course, I hit textbooks and I read up about things, but, you know, you can only use some of this stuff to a degree. And the other thing I do when I'm editing is go back through and take out irrelevant facts, things that I've learned about a subject that, you know, it's just cluttering up a story. It's not relevant to the narrative. You know, the narrative really does come first. So the research is used in a way, you might not use some of the research, but it has gone into informing the story and the setting and the subject a lot of the time. So again, it's this idea of a hinterland, everything that's operating outside the story has somehow made that story. And it's just as important in a way as what's held inside that the reader will get their hands on.
For me, the main feeling after reading the story, particularly once we get to the end of the story, is a feeling of being quite deeply unsettled. And there's, you know, I sort of feel that a great story, and I think this is a great story, is it's always not about what the story's about, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's always about something else. This story is not about mink. It's right. Not about necessarily a woman caring for her friend.
Right.
What for you is this story about? What's it really about?
Well, I think as with a lot of the stories in the book, it's about somebody asserting their own existence. You know, her friend is dying. She's doing something about that, you know, in a kind of caring fashion. But actually, she's enjoying the fact that she's hunting, and she's the sort of premier hunter in the environment with her brothers. You know, there's a line in it, you know, we are the wolves, we are the lions, you know, talking about her and her brothers hunting and the fact that they have precedence in the environment, and they do. So she is asserting her own experience, and by virtue of the fact that a friend is dying, and I think she probably knows that she's dying or suspects that she's dying, and the doctor does too, she knows that she is living, that she's alive, and it's about her experience of that. It's also about not having any faith, not having any religious faith, I think. But again, through that, you know, because she's sort of there are a couple of references to, you know, biblical references in there, and it is, as I said earlier in the event today, a slightly heretical story. So it's existential, I suppose. It's an existential story, and she ends up asserting herself in the environment and knowing actually that premiership that she has is temporary. You know, it is temporary. Yes, she's alive and her friend is dying, so that she's one up in those stakes. But she's not going to last either. You know, there are moors and mountains is what it comes down to in the end. The last line, you know, this river that she's been hunting along to get the mink, you know, it's winding its way through an inverse Eden. So essentially, it's a beautiful landscape. It's a terrible landscape. It's a landscape that's completely other from all the kind of ideological constructs, especially the Lake District. I mean, that's one region where you end up thinking in this way. It's a region that's been reconstituted through art and literature and thought. So it's a kind of nice setting for this idea of... it's a sort of anatomical investigation of the landscape in a way. I'm really... Mm.
Where I felt the rug being kind of pulled out from under me, which I like. I think in a way you want that as a short story reader, don't you? In a way, was where she says, you know, where she's talking about a friend. She says, I did miss her gentle candor, but my dreams were not of Magda. The truth of death is a peculiar thing, for when they leave us, the beloved are as if they never were. And I felt quite disappointed in Dolly at that point. I was like, what are you saying there? You're saying that basically, well, sod Magda, she's dead now.
Yeah.
But there was a sort of there was a thrill there as well, that yeah. she could be so raw in that self-knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, and that crops up all through the collection, you're right. I mean, that's definitely a kind of rug pull moment, and that realisation. Some writers don't believe that the short story should contain epiphanic moments, because life doesn't. But I actually disagree with that, because I think life does. And I think I think epiphanic moments are rug pull moments. They're the moments when your heart just drops something. There is dread, there is clarity. It may last for seconds, but you cannot say that life and... doesn't include that, and it does. So that moment is essential to the story, because again, she's saying she does, you know, she does miss her friend, but essentially she's gone, you know, she's gone, she's kind of vaporized, and that's the reality of it. So this is it's kind of northern honesty in a way, you know. Actually, I didn't miss her. I missed her a bit, and then I didn't miss her because I got on with things, but what I missed was hunting along the river. That's what did it for me, you know. Kind of an honest confession. In the last story, set in Finland, Jeopardy on a lake, you know, a woman decides to row out into the lake to try and find her lover who's gone for a swim and disappeared from sight. And this perilous situation is playing out in her head that he's drowning. So mm-hmm. she goes out into the lake in a boat that hasn't been, this is spoiling it for anyone reading it. You know, hasn't put the bung in the boat. The boat starts to fill with water. She's out into the middle of the lake. At that point, she panics, rescue aborted, you know. Holy fuck, I'm in jeopardy. I don't give a shit about him. I probably do give a shit about him still, but actually the essential thing now is me. And I suppose lots of the characters hit on that through that very selfish, it's not Red in Tooth and Claw, I suppose maybe it's a Darwinian thing essentially. It's me. Oh shit, I'm up against it now. You know, interesting when beloved people are up against it, you will do great things. You will make a mink cape for a friend who's dying. You will row out into a lake to go and find your missing lover. But more interesting to me are those moments of, you know, oh yeah, well now everything swings around and it's on you. What are you going to do about it? Fascinating. I'm fascinated by that. So those are the rug pull moments really in the stories.
And those are the gritty moments as well. I mean, there's a line I love from from a review you wrote recently in The Guardian of the Juno Diaz collection, and you said something like, less a moral waltz, more venereal merengue.
Yeah. Sorry, Gina.
And it does seem, it seems that your stories do that kind of venereal merengue as well. I mean, they do take risks. When you sit down to write a story, are you aware of that? Do you get that kind of, do you get some sort of visceral tug that sort of says, right, I'm taking a risk here, and And what is that? What is that risk often?
Oh, yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? But you're right. I mean, I do think, and it comes down to how do you know when you're going to write a short story or start something else. But with short stories, I think, yeah, there is definitely something crackly going on under the surface of the skin. There is a sense that, not that there aren't disturbing things that you want to write about in novels, but I think I feel a sense of disturbance when I'm about to write a short story. And I think, you know, if you could get some kind of like Gaia counter that was for, you know, for sort of fictional inspiration and pass it over me at that point, there would be a high reading going on. I'm not sure what it is, but maybe it's a question of which stories I've read and enjoyed in the past and how and what I associate the short story with and to, and that would be ghost stories, that would be, you know, very disturbing American short stories. So for me, there has always been a sense, rather than comedy or mirth, although I love comedic short story writers, Kevin Barry, absolute genius. I love being disturbed, you know, and that's as a reader. And so that's what I want to do as a writer. And it's not a deliberate thing. It's knowing that perhaps the episode that you're about to write about is the disturbance of the normal somehow, is there is a note of heresy to it. There is something about it that is going to upend, you know, life and the reader. You know, short stories, it's often about what's sublimated. It's about a kind of shadow psychology. Everything's going on under the surface. It might rupture through at some point. It probably will at some point, or it might not. So it's about what's not being said as well as what's being said. It's about what's not happening as well as what is happening. You know, these sort of haunted synaptic human moments, just it's a kind of pulse of chemical in the brain, or a sort of a thought that comes to you, or it's a sort of, again, it's those moments that that sort of wake you up, shake you up as a human being, remind you that it's when something goes wrong often, or what's normal and natural and acceptable is gone for a moment. And you know, this is how we used to survive. You know, there would be jeopardy. There would be more jeopardy than there is now all around us, and that would make the human experience much shorter usually, but also perhaps redder, perhaps more acute. That might be wrong. I might be having a romantic version of what it was like to be a caveman or a woman. I don't know, but I do think that's what I mean by it. Are these moments when all of a sudden you are reminded that something very red is very close, actually. It's much closer to you than you think it is. You know, driving along in your comfortable car with an airbag. You know, taking... there's a whole riff at the end of How to Paint a Dead Man, which is one of my novels, which in itself is like a short story, and it's talking about, you know, we think we're safe, you know, we'll take a pill and to increase the ecstasy, or we'll go on a ride to scare ourselves, and we'll eat oysters because we enjoy them. But actually, you can't always preclude the bolt being taken out of the roller coaster, you know, or rattling out, or toxicity in an oyster. There is always something there that's going to do you in. Perhaps I'm a catastrophist, perhaps that's what it is. And Those are the scenarios that I tend to try and work up into a story.
So would you say that if someone's writing a story and maybe it's feeling a little bit too comfortable, or it's not working in some way, and reminding oneself or finding some way of introducing some of that red that you're talking about into the story can be a way of waking the story up?
Yeah, but again, if you're... You don't just want to give it an injection somehow, because you'll end up with some weird steroidal short story that just looks like its muscles are false, you know? So it's about being true to what you're... I mean, there are some great short stories where, as I say, things are muted and not happening and conversations are going on, and you know that there's a conversation going on underneath that. You know, James Salter's very good at this. There are sort of conversations had between lovers who meet in shops, and you know, it's a conversation about the disruption in their lives or why they broke up, but it's being had in a different way. So nothing can happen, but something needs to be suggested, I think. Otherwise you end up with a squib. You know, a kind of damp squib of a story. And that's fine. Some people can probably do a lot with the damp squib, but I can't.
And what do you do if you've written a story and either somebody else or you yourself realise that you've got a bit of a sort of a damp squib on your hand.
Yeah, it just goes, you know, it just goes into the really? into the pot of stories.
You don't try and resuscitate it in
no,
some way
I might try and resuscitate it for a bit, but I'm coming around to the notion that it's like pottery. You sort of have to throw the lump right in the first draft. That's terrible metaphor, I'm really sorry, but you know, there always needs to be something right about the first draft. It's not perfect, but with a short story you need the kind of somehow the shape or something needs to be correct in the first instance for it to, at least in my experience while writing, for it to go on and work well. You know, something that's been really overworked may never work, for me anyway. So the stories in this collection, there are 7 of them, and there were more that were written and didn't make it in, and that has to be the way of it with a short story, because short story will not bear too much error. It won't bear too much imperfection. Not imperfection. Wrongness. It just won't. It won't carry it. It won't work. It will only work if there is a degree of rightness to it in the beginning, I think. So there's no harm in writing a short story and nothing happens with it. You just put it away. It's an exercise in writing a short story. You'll probably go on to write a much better one soon after.
I mean, in terms of a collection of short stories, I often have the feel that a collection of short stories is a little bit like an album. And so in any album, you know, you're going to have one or two of those sort of killer tracks that people sort of seem to recognize. Everyone sort of goes, yeah, but that one, I mean, it might be the first track or whatever it is, people just seem to recognize that those are the songs that make that album, and the others are good, but but there's something about those killer tracks. So I suppose the question is, what do you think are the killer tracks on this album?
Yeah, there's only one, the last story. I think that's the only proper short
and
story.
And what makes it a killer track?
For me, it's got the right balance of narrative drive, description. It enters and exits in the right place. It touches. There are lots of layers going on. There is. It's a book about disaster on a lake, which is sort of self-induced and imagined at the same time. But also, you know, the couple are reading a book about how the end of the world's going to happen. You know, asteroid impact, biological warfare. Really unlikely, probably. Chances are it's going to end for you because you've left a bung out of a boat. So there are kind of these levels all around. It's got a very standard metaphor in it as well. You know, the idea of falling in love and the deepness of the lake. The two things are they're allied. They're in there. They're right together. It's sort of, you have these scenes together. She's thinking about making love with him and how she feels about him while swimming in the lake, and it's really deep, and she has a panic attack. Well, she's having a panic attack for two reasons, really. Not just because she's in a very deep lake and she can't see the bottom. Very simple metaphor, but it's in there, and it kind of worked right for that story, I think. It also has all the things that I really like working with. It has wilderness, but it has a wilderness in summer, which is a false wilderness. It is still a wilderness, but it looks false. So I kind of like the idea of this couple thinking they know what they're doing in you know, backwaters of Finland. And they kind of do, but they kind of don't, you know. I don't know, it just felt like everything was working right in the story. It was the right amount of dialogue. It was beautiful, terrifying, haunted.
It's sort of also about a kind of loss of control, isn't it? Because we wander around thinking we're in control. I mean, he sort of says, right, I'm going to go on my swim, and I'm going to conquer this lake. And of course, he's perhaps not going to conquer the lake because he's going to die, and she's going to die trying to rescue him.
Right. Well, they're both going to live. We don't really know because that's the thing. The story exits at a certain point, which seems like a kind of cruel cliffhanger. But I don't think it is. I think that was exactly the right point to exit, because we know that this whole thing has been like a psychological sort of peril in her head, and she's imagined that he's in jeopardy. She doesn't know that he is. This rowing out into the lake to save him, it could be a complete invention. It might not be necessary, so you don't really know that. And it felt like to validate or invalidate her imagined fear would be wrong. We just needed to stay in that frame, really. I like that it ends with dialogue from a local person who's lent them the cabin on the lake. who just says to them, you know, she remembers this person saying to them when they first arrive, yeah, we don't come to this cabin in the winter because there's 20 feet of snow and, you know, there's the cabin is buried. So you get that sense of this is wilderness that's gone wrong for them, but actually, to a local person, the wilderness, again, there's another layer to it. There's a further wilderness out there. But these are just details that I like in the story. I like that it's kind of in real time too. Again, that's a sort of that was a method that I could use that would make me think about narrative thrust and plot in a way. So it's pretty much in real time. It's not exactly in real time, but you're sort of going through things step by step. She's thinking about him being lost. She's remembering their lovemaking. She's launching the boat. She's rowing out. It's all happening. You're right there with the action. So there's a sense of sort of drive to it and excitement to it, and works like a film device, I suppose.
Mm.
And it's sexy. Sexy, the other thing about short stories, they can be so sexy, so erotic, so disturbing on sexual levels. James Salter got a brilliant short story called Give, which is, you know, it's about a man who, on his wife's birthday, it's revealed that he's been having an affair with the male lodger that's living there. It's brilliant. Mm. It's sort of, again, in, out, kind of affair happening, you know, discovery, just enough. You know, certain writers have said, just steer away from sex. It's too difficult to write about well. And it clangs, it really clangs if it's written about badly. But for me, again, sex, such a driving force. It's that idea of the feral, how humans behave, misbehave, those energies that will lead you to great things and to ruin your life. How could you not write about sex? It becomes, for me, it becomes odd to leave it out of the work.
Mm. Well, mm. I think we're winding down to...
We're just getting going. We're talking about sex.
Once you're talking about sex, it's sort of, there is nothing more to say, really, at that point, is there? It's just been a really, really thrilling discussion. I don't know how you were able to sort of deliver, because you did a whole session before and then you've come and spoken for this podcast as well, but thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Just for your energy and enthusiasm about the short story form. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Well, hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. Do come back for the next one. And if you haven't already done so, you might want to check out all the other short story amazingness on the Thresholds website, as well as the Small Wonder Festival part of the net that can be found by simply typing Small Wonder into Google or any internet search engine of your choice. Cheerio.